Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Good morning, I'm Christopher Purdy. Welcome to All Sides Weekend. This is the book show where we talk about books, we talk about reads, we talk about what you want to read, what you should be reading, maybe what you didn't like reading. With our panel, Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Cassie's blog, thelongestchapter.com, is very important to anyone who loves books, who loves to read. Michelle Herman is here. She was professor emerita from The Ohio State University. She is an author. Her latest book is If You Say So, a collection of essays. She is also a dancer, a teacher. And Chris Hickey is here from the Columbus Library. And Chris Hickey brings us quick picks every month, those books everybody wants to read. And Chris Hickey's going to tell us how to jump the line. But the first thing, Chris Hickey, congratulations to you and your colleagues for the Columbus Book Festival last weekend.
Thank you very much. This was our third book festival, and it was just fun to walk around and see so many smiling people and see the rooms packed. I was thrilled for the authors. We have a great time putting it on, and we're delighted that Columbus loves it too.
I walked around. You had a lot of tents in the outdoor area and the main library, and a lot of events inside as well. There was a magnificent rainstorm on Saturday afternoon. People took shelter where they could with booksellers, and then when it stopped raining, they just continued on. Nobody took off. Nobody left. You had marvelous crowds, and I will say two words to you, Wally Lamb.
Oh, goodness. I was delighted to meet him at the preview party. He walked in by himself, and you know, this is a person who was on Oprah's podcast, and he just, you know, walks in very kind and sweet. So I walked up and introduced myself, and he's just lovely.
He told a story about how 20 years ago he was doing the laundry, and he was putting in the, and his wife handed him the phone and said, "It's for you." And this voice said, "Wally, it's Oprah Winfrey. What are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing the laundry." And stop pretending you're Oprah Winfrey. Who was just calling me? But that was the first time she chose one of his books. She's done it a couple of times.
Yeah, this is the third time she's chosen him.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, congratulations to you and your colleagues. It was a magnificent afternoon. Give us a quick pick.
All right.
And explain what they are.
Okay. So quick picks are the hot books. We have long hold lists. So if you come into one of our buildings, we have displays in every building, same books in every building. And you can, the thing that you have on hold, you can grab it, you can check out, and you basically skip the line. So I'm going to share a romanticy title. So this is one of the most popular genres that's out there. This is high fantasy with spicy romance. And this one is the new Rachel Gillig. She wrote One Dark Window, and this is the first in series. It's called The Night and the Moth. And this is about a woman named Six, and she is a diviner. So she lives at a citadel with five other diviners and the abbess. And the abbess drowns the girls. They're drowned in magical waters, revived, and then they dream of the omens. So paying customers will come and have their... they read the omens for them to see if the omens favor them. And so there are five other diviners there, and there are also sentient gargoyles, which are kind of like your comedy relief. They're really funny. And the main one, he calls everyone Bartholomew, and we won't know why until much later in the book. And she, the abbess, and the other diviners wear a shroud over their eyes. And they say it's to so they can be anonymous, but there's really another reason, which we find out later in the book. So at the beginning, the young new king comes to have his omens read, and it does not go the way he would have liked. And he brings with him Sir Roderick, who is a knight, and he and Six are drawn to each other. So that's the romanticy. It's like maybe 2 out of 5 Chili Peppers, a little bit of spice, but not like a ton of spice. So then after that, the diviners one by one start disappearing. And so when she is the last one left, the king and Sir Roderick help her and the gargoyle, who calls everyone Bartholomew, they escape. And the king says, I will help you find the other diviners if you help me hunt down the omens. And the omens are these godlike, they're kind of people, but also kind of not. And they're all in different regions. And in these regions, they worship these omens. And so every region has their own culture, their own monsters, their own creatures. And she's a beautiful world builder. So it's very immersive. And it was delightful. I loved it. It was just, if you want to be immersed in a fantasy world, if you like Sarah J. Maas, Rebecca Yarros, The Night and the Moth by Rachel Gillig is for you.
Romanticy. Did you just make that up?
I didn't.
Seriously.
I did not make it up, but it is out there. It is popular. It is ACOTAR, a Court of Thorn and Roses, Fourth Wing. That's just some of the titles, but epic.
My literary agent has told me that that's all publishers want, that when she calls them to say, I've got a manuscript to send you, they only want to know if it's romanticy.
Wow.
That has taken over.
I had to write that down. Michelle Herman, we know what you've been writing. What have you been reading?
So the opposite of romanticy, so Jacqueline Woodson is a writer I have heard about since I was a teenager. I'm guessing that Chris knows her.
Love her. Yeah. She's wonderful.
She mostly wrote middle grade and young adult books, but I just read her adult novel, Another Brooklyn, because I've been reading books about women's and girls' friendships. I've been interested in that lately. I've been interested in it always, but I've made a kind of search for books on the subject. And this book was written about 10 years ago. It's a very slim novel, and I can't begin to talk about how much I loved it. It's narrated by the now adult character of August, who's an anthropologist whose research on customs and practices around death takes her all over the world. There's a very slow reveal in the course of the book of something that happened in her own family 3 decades before. And that's what gives the book its shape. But the story of her friendship with Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi, so these are 4 black girls in the 1970s in Bushwick, Brooklyn, who are holding on to one another for dear life, is really what's at the book's heart. It's that friendship. And the narrative is in and out of the past and present. It traces August's childhood from the beginning on a decaying family farm in Tennessee and the coming undone of her mother after the Vietnam War death of her mother's sensitive artistic brother, August's Uncle Clyde. All the way through the move to Brooklyn and the years August spends growing up there, sharing the weight of growing up girl is the way she thinks about it with her 3 best friends. The novel opens with the line, for a long time, my mother wasn't dead yet. And I kept going back to that sentence because the meaning of it seems to change as the book goes. It was just a gorgeous book, and I hope I'm not making it sound grim because it really wasn't grim at all, despite all the talk of death.
Another Brooklyn, right? By
Another Brooklyn, Jacqueline Woodson.
Recommended to us by Michelle Herman here on All Sides Weekend, the book show where we talk about books, we recommend books. You don't have to write it down because we will. Chris Hickey,
yes.
God bless her, always puts it on.
I make a list.
And always puts it on Facebook and the library as well, has it with links to getting it from the library. Mm-hmm. And let's have some romanticy from from Cassie Rose.
Romanticy or death, which one?
Yeah. Go.
Right. I'm going to recommend a book called Fresh, Green Life by Sebastian Castillo. And I'm going to tell you, I can guarantee this is going to be one of my favorite books of the year. It is a story. I'll just start out to tell you what the story is. And it captivated me in a way that totally surprised me. And that has a lot to do with the narrator's voice. And the narrator is the author's name, Sebastian Castillo. But he's a man who has lived for a year in his apartment in Philadelphia without speaking to anyone, having his necessities delivered to him. And that's because he had, oh, and he goes to the gym every day, well, 6 days a week. So he's quite buff now. He's about in his 30s. He quit his job as an adjunct professor when he had a year prior when he had a heart scare. So this is what he decided to do. I'm going to just focus on organic food, exercising, and I'm not going to talk to anyone. So here a year later, it is New Year's Eve, and he has received an invitation from a professor that was his mentor in college 10 years ago, a liberal arts college that was experimental. He's told that his three friends will be there, Robert and Thomas and Maria in italics, because the professor who is inviting him knows that Sebastian had a little thing for her that was never happened. So the first part of the, so that's what the description of the book is going is about. It says this guy gets this invitation and is he going to go or not? And that's what you think the book is going to be about. But I am telling you that the second part of the book, it is much more than that. The first part, it's New Year's Eve day, and you are getting the background about the university days, the background about his three friends, the wacky professor who would go on and on, a class about Dante, but he's going to talk about Nietzsche, and all of this information that tells you about the background. And meanwhile, Sebastian is practicing the speeches he's going to give to Maria when he sees her at this party, you know, and thinking about how he's going to enlighten her to his magnificence. And he's going to tell her that his buff body is not out of ego, but it's because he's found the person that he is. And you're reading this and thinking, dear Lord, buddy, you are going to lose this one big time. So then you get to the second part, and he is walking the suburban streets at night to go to the professor's house. I'm not going to tell you what happens in the second part, because I'm going to tell you it is not at all what you think it will be about. It is extraordinary. It is also the ending of the book. There is one of the best scenes I have ever read in literature about what goes on between two characters. It is such a phenomenal second half and ending that I put the book down and just did like, oh my gosh.
You're very careful when you really recommend something the way you just are now. You don't do this all the time.
Correct.
So, Sebastian Castillo, did you know his work before?
I did not. And this comes out from a press that is not from the Big Five. So, you know, my concern would be that, or not concern, but I doubt it's going to get on a lot of radar screens.
Who published it?
It's Soft Skull Press.
Oh, I know them. Yeah, they actually, it's a small independent press, but they have a very wide reach in the literary mm-hmm. world. So other writers at least will know about it. If people talk about it the way you are, I'm mm-hmm. excited. Yeah.
And also at the end of the book, you are given something. You are given something that you can walk away with.
The title again.
It's called Fresh, with a comma, Fresh Green Life by Sebastian Castillo.
Okay, Fresh, comma, Green Life. Y'all listen to that, okay? Write it down. Fresh, comma, Green Life. If Cassie Rose raves about a book like that, then we all need to read this book. I hope it's in the library.
But it is in the library.
Okay.
I checked ahead
of time. When we get off the air at noon, there'll probably be 150 requests for it. So, okay, I'll be 151. Thank you very much, Cassie Rose. This is All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. You can tell we're really off to a flying start here today with our recommendations, and we will be back in 1 minute. Don't go away.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We are back. This is All Sides Weekend. This is the book show. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com with Michelle Herman, who is professor emerita of creative writing and English at The Ohio State University. She's an author and a dancer and a teacher. And Chris Hickey, who brings us the books you have to stand in line to read, the quick picks from the Columbus Library. Give us another one.
All right, let's talk about Ruth Ware's new book. So she wrote The Woman in Cabin 10, which was a huge bestseller. And this is the follow-up to that. This is called The Woman in Suite 11. So the main character is Lo Blacklick. She's in Cabin 10. And there's other characters, if you're a fan of that book, that will show up in this book as well. So Lo Blacklick is trying to jump back into her career of travel journalism, and she's finding that it is a very different ballgame post-pandemic than it was years before. But she is invited to this luxurious hotel, this luxurious Swiss hotel, by the billionaire who owns it. And she's hoping to get an interview with him, but easier said than done. And then one night she gets a call to show up at his suite. And even though there are so many warning signs and so many red flags, she goes there anyway. And the woman who answers the door claims to be this man's mistress and is in some kind of jeopardy. So then from there, there's this cat and mouse game that takes you across Europe. So if you want that escapist, I'm running through the streets of Europe type of read, this is definitely going to be good for you. So Ruth Ware is a big fan of Agatha Christie, but she didn't want to do the private island, luxury train thing. But she, Ruth Ware, loves a truly fabulous hotel. And she calls it, and she said, in quote, she wanted to create a decadently luxe ambiance of the places inhabited by people with too much money to function normally. Oh. So we've got a thriller, escapist, and just a fun ride.
Can you jump into this Ruth Ware book without having read her previously?
You could, but I think you'll get more out of it because the characters are popping in.
You'll get more out of it
if you have read the previous one. You'll get more out of it, but you could still probably enjoy it on its own. Mm-hmm.
Do you notice in the summertime more traffic? Does it make a difference?
Definitely some. Okay. But I mean, we're pretty busy year round.
Yeah,
lots of good circulation. But yes, I mean, we see more families in the summer because with our summer reading challenge that wraps up at the end of the month.
Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, summer reading challenge. It's so much fun. And it's not just for children. It's for adults, too. And we have treasure chests that people can choose things. And adults love it, too. So there's, all kinds of bookmarks and bottle stickers and enamel pins, which I was very excited about.
Unless I'm wrong, there are some branches that are also feeding children.
Yes, we have a number of locations that provide summer lunch, so children can come and eat. Some branches also have snack, and that information is on our website. And we have flyers at the various branches that can tell you exactly where to go.
If you follow this program, you know that I'm a huge fan, as most people are, of the Columbus Metropolitan Library and our friend Chris Hickey, who represents the library for us. And I want everybody to know that next Friday at 11, Lauren Hagan, the new CEO of the library, will be my guest here on this program. So I hope that people will be tuning in. I thank you for the latest quick picks. Michelle Herman, what do you have for us to read?
So I have another book about women's friendship. This one, I wish I could speak Spanish because I'm afraid I'm going to butcher the author's name. Her name is Guadalupe Nettle or Nettel, translated from the Spanish by Rosalind Harvey. She is a Mexican writer whom I had not read before, and now I'm ashamed that I haven't read her before. I'm going to get all her earlier books. This is about the friendship between Alina and Laura in their mid-30s in Mexico City, and it's told through Laura's eyes. What the book kind of insists it's about, at least what the publisher insists it's about, is about the divide between women who choose motherhood and women who actively do not. But that is not at all what the book is about. I think that might have been a kind of a way to hook certain readers in. I mean, it's true that Laura has decided against having children and, in fact, early on has her tubes tied to make sure she doesn't change her mind. And Alina wants to have a child and does have a child. And it's also true that part of what had united them as other friends from when they were girls in their 20s have begun to fall away and get married and have children was their shared conviction that motherhood is off the table. But when they come to what might have been and what the novel prepares us to expect to be, and what it first even seems to be, which is a crossroads that will separate them, because Laura reveals that she's had her tubes tied, and in return, Alina confesses that she's been trying to have a baby. The character of Laura and the novelist surprise us, and the character surprises herself by drawing closer to her friend, which was a turn I just really loved. And so what ends up following is a really moving and really engrossing portrait of a friendship that sustains the two women, even as each of their separate lives are challenged in various ways, and they each find themselves changing in ways they couldn't have foreseen. Alina's storyline made me think about a nonfiction book by Heather Lanier, which I don't think I've talked about on this show before, a memoir called Raising a Rare Girl. Heather was a graduate student of mine many years ago, and she was for years primarily a poet, but she began writing nonfiction, and her first child was born with a rare genetic disorder. She was told that the child would not live very long. It's exactly what the character of Alina is told when her child is born with a disorder. And Heather's book about embracing her daughter for who she is and getting her every possible kind of help, I really think, I know it would be hard for someone who's pregnant to read it, but I feel like if you have a young child, it's a book about being the mother your child needs you to be. And that's the turn this book takes. Alina becomes the mother her child needs her to be. And Laura is so invested in this child and also becomes invested in another child. And it just, I found reading it to be like transformational, actually. And it's gorgeously written, so why I wanted to make sure to give credit to the translator too.
I'm curious to know, because you said that this writer is new to you.
Yeah.
How did this book get you? Did it just look good somewhere?
No, I have actually actively been on a search for books about women's friendships, using every possible Google term I could come up with. And also looking specifically for some by women of color, because my what falls into my lap is going to be books by American, mostly white women. And I really wanted to make sure I was looking wider than that and looking internationally. I reserved them all from the library. I took them all out. I read the first 20 pages of all of them. And then I read all the way through the ones that really gripped me.
I have read her work. She's very good. Guadalupe Nettle.
Well, I'm going to go back. So is it pronounced Guadalupe Nettle?
That's how I pronounced it.
I hope that some Spanish-speaking listener writes in a comment.
Just read the book.
Stillborn. I'm not crazy about the title. Yeah. I think the title is unfortunate, and it's probably a bad translation of the original title. But yes, it's called another slim novel. So,
recommendation from Michelle Herman on this edition of All Sides Weekend, the book show. And Cassie Rose, before, I just want to go very quickly around the table. I'll start with Cassie Rose. We were talking about romanticizing. I wrote that down because I never heard it before. Genre. Do you have a favorite genre?
I do, but it is also, there's controversy now whether or not people do say it's literary fiction. But it's controversy isn't the right word. But it's, I think, because Amazon will now list things as literary fiction that really isn't literary fiction, and just there's a lot of crossing over. But typically, what it is, I look for the rich characters, the rich story, the involving complexity that gives me something to think about. But in that is just a good story. It's what all the classics were.
Sometimes you need a snack and sometimes you need a meal.
That's
you
it.
You know, and there's not, and they're both wonderful.
And you know, I sprinkle my reading life with snacks. I've got a snack here and in the stack. But it's just, I love the books and that have the characters and that are memorable and have the life situations that resonate with me, or that also that teach me, you know, how to stand beside other human beings that I wouldn't know how to stand beside because I don't know their life.
And they could be books you want to read again.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
How about you, Michelle? You
well, you know, I want to piggyback on what Cassie said, because literary fiction didn't exist as a genre until there were so many genres, mm-hmm. science fiction and fantasy, and then, mm-hmm. you know, portmanteaus like romanticism. So literary fiction was, you know, distinguishing it from horror and everything else. But now what's happening is within so-called literary fiction, there's upmarket fiction, mm-hmm. right? And women's fiction. And it has become meaningless. But I will say, I used to say I don't read any genre writing at all. But now I guess I have to say I read literary fiction. And there are moments, you know, someone like Ursula Le Guin, who's writing in a genre, who writes science fiction, who's very much a literary writer. I also, in particular, prefer to read literature that is contemporary of its time. I mean, I'll read books written in the 19th century, but I'm not crazy about historical novels. Don't ask me why. If someone is writing in the 21st century, I want to read a book written in the 21st century, and so on.
How about you, Chris Hickey?
So what I've been drawn to lately is a genre that's relatively new, and it's called cozy fantasy or gentle fantasy.
I like that.
And it's just delightful, and they're feel-good fantasies, so that you don't have like the deep, dark political intrigue. They might be a little bit spicy, but generally aren't as much. And so I moderated a panel, and I learned quite a bit about this genre. And what was shared with me is, you know, romanticy, and again, this is a generalization, is often, you know, white heteronormative characters, where a cozy fantasy, you see a lot of different kinds of characters. So more queer characters, more people of color. And so they're just kind of, I think of them as like warm chocolate chip cookie books.
I am fascinated that sweet. That queer is a part of the equation of gentle.
Yes.
Because the last
yes.
time we talked, I told you my daughter is really into queer romanticism.
Yes.
And
wow, I got to write that one down.
Yes.
And cozy.
And that's what the authors shared when they talked about it. They just feel that there's space for more people.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting.
I like that a lot. I think that's,
and they're just, they're delightful. I like going into the other worlds and where people are kind to each other.
So typically in, what do I know? I've never read a fantasy
novel. Well, there's also
novel.
Cozy mysteries now.
It's similar to that. It is similar to that. Mm-hmm. Cozy mystery, but it's fantasy.
And I want to get back to a recommendation from Cassie Rose.
I'm going to recommend the book.
Is it cozy or?
No, it's a collection of short stories that is absolutely outstanding. It's lots of fun. It's called Fools for Love by Helen Schulman.
And speaking of which, you'll be at Gramercy Books next.
On this coming Tuesday at 7 o'clock in conversation.
Talk.
Yes. So, and Helen Schulman is delightful, and she has many novels to her name, several best-selling. She's very talented, warm, witty, and I'm guaranteeing that we will have a wonderful conversation. And also because of this book, these collection of stories, which I'll talk about, like the lead story, for example, which is Fools for Love. And in it, a young woman named Anna is in the East Village, and she is in New York City, and she is going to a production, an alternative production of Sam Shepard's famous play, Fool for Love. And her husband, Miguel, is starring in the role. And what Helen Schulman captures in this story is that young, innocent love, because Anna is, they're married, they are soulmates. She's going, and she's a playwright. It's New York. They have all of their life ahead of them. And Helen captures this so well. And Anna is narrating this from later years. And she says in the beginning, I still believe all this to be true. And you read that line. And if you have ever had that kind of love and moment in your life, you will know exactly what this is and how she brings it to life. Well, Anna goes to the production and she sees something there that Miguel is in the performance. And she knows a truth that she already knows, but this time now it comes up and it sits on her shoulders, and she knows this will doom the marriage. I know that it will not be able to last. However, it's not, you know, love isn't, was not our problem, she says. And she writes, she said, we were soulmates, we were fools. There are great lines in this story. I loved him too much, I didn't love her enough. What Helen Schulman is capturing here is that young love. And it's before the responsibilities, before the long love of marriage, and that time that so many people can look back to and remember. Now, these are linked stories. So Anna and Miguel and a man named Walker in the story come back, because essentially the incident in this story is how Anna finds her second husband. But the truth in the story is about that time. I still believe all this to be true. The stories in the middle of the book are also about love, but it can be attachments that we think are love but may not be love. And some of them are very funny with some extreme situations, such as the woman who is a coordinator for admissions at a college, and she gets this application and the name and everything on it. She is dead certain it is the resurrection of her high school boyfriend, the boy she loved who was killed in a car accident. And oddly, it's the same birth date, but they left off the date of the year. So what goes on in that story, though, is, I don't know, but this is the kind of stuff I want to talk to Helen Schulman about. Is it about holding on to love, or is this about, you know, a woman in her 40s trying to pretend she's young again in back in high school?
Or is it romantasy?
Or is it romantasy? Yes. There's stories here that are about denial, that are about jealousy. There is a baby that narrates a story who is narcissistic, and he sabotages his mother's love affair.
I was
thinking the same thing. Yeah.
And he says, I did it for love. And therein, you know, I want to talk with Helen about this and say, how did you decide to choose to have a baby narrating a story about jealousy?
I'm so disappointed, because I always wanted to write a novel from the point of view of a baby. Mm-hmm. I had never seen it done.
Well, she nails it. Damn. And it'll be a great conversation.
Remind us about the Gramercy book. Just make sure everybody understands what you're doing and when.
Sure. It is this coming Tuesday at 7 o'clock. I'll be in conversation with Helen Schulman, Fools for Love. You do need to register for the event, which you can do on the Gramercy Bookshop website. Just click on their link for events, and it'll pop right up.
They're very smart to have you there, Cassie Rose.
Thank you.
That's going to be a wonderful event, and I'm going to go register right now. Maybe I'll crash. You know how I am. This is All Sides Weekend, the book show. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're going to take a break and come right back. Don't go away.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We are back, All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, WOH's book critic, with author, teacher, dancer Michelle Herman, and with Chris Hickey from the Columbus Public Library, Columbus Metropolitan Library, I think. And I do want to point out the program next Friday, a week from today, will feature Lauren Hagen, who is the new CEO of the Columbus Library. She's not new to the library. She was the chief financial officer for a while, but now she has become the chief executive officer. She will be here next Friday at 11. And Maureen O'Brien, who 3 days ago started work as the new CEO of the Columbus Symphony. I figured I'd let her unpack her bags before I started bothering her, but I didn't. I bothered her anyway, and she was very gracious. And she will be with us as well next Friday. And my friend Chad Whittington, who heads CAPA. So that's going to be a wonderful conversation next Friday, All Sides Arts and Culture at 11 o'clock. But I digress. Going back to books, give us another quick pick, Chris Hickey.
So I was talking about cozy fantasy as a genre, and so this is a very hot one that's a quick pick. It is called A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping, and it's by Sangu Mendana, and she wrote A Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, and that book was a huge bestseller. So this story is about Sarah Swan, and she at one time was the most powerful witch in Britain. And then she used her powers to resurrect her Aunt Jasmine and then lost her powers. So now she helps her Aunt Jasmine run this magical inn, and she has just enough magic left to stop the roof from leaking. But she can't do much more than that.
Better than I can do. Good. Yeah.
And so there's this fantastic, eccentric cast of characters that live in this inn. And this inn, you can only find it if you need it. So the average person can't find it. So someone who's lost, someone who needs a place to be, can find this inn. And Sarah figures out that there is a spell out there that will help her to regain her magic. And around that time, a handsome man comes to the inn on a dark, stormy night. And he is a magical librarian for the guild. And the guild is run by a man who will do anything to stop Sarah from getting her magic back. And so his name, Luke, is the name of the handsome historian. And he thinks he's only going to stop at the inn for just a little bit. But he finds that it is a wonderful place for his younger sister, Posy. And she is a witch, and she is a neurodivergent young witch, which means her magic is unpredictable. And Sangu Mendana just writes this character so beautifully and with so much care, and just really celebrates the beauty of the neurodivergent brain. And so Posy has this place of belonging. And general fantasy people are generally kind to each other, and that's what makes this genre so comforting. And the interactions between the guests at this inn, they live there pretty much full time, is just charming. There's a fox, a talking fox that was a witch who a spell went terribly wrong. There's a knight named Sir Nicholas who is a knight at the local Ren Fair, and he never breaks character. He's always wearing his armor, and he's just very funny. It's just super sweet. This is like that warm chocolate chip cookie type of book.
Yeah, but I can see what, I mean, I'm not a fantasy or a romantic fantasy person, but I can see when you talk about these books, I can see the attraction to it, the desire to be, even the previous one that you had talked about, this, how you can go into this world. It's like going through the wardrobe in Narnia.
It very much is.
And that's where you can go into this world that where good things happen, where bad things happen, likely, probably it's a battle between, you know, good and evil. And just what you said here about it's this inn is, or this place is available only to the people who need it. They're the only ones that can see it.
Yes.
I love that concept.
Yeah, me too.
And she describes the magic, and the magic is different in all the books, but I love how she describes Sarah's magic as she feels she's filled with these little stars, and she misses the stars, but she loves her Aunt Jasmine more. And there's an undead chicken. So there's a spell that goes wrong.
Now you tell us.
And Ruru, that was buried in the back garden, pops up, and he's just running around as a skeleton chicken.
Is there a distinction between cozy fantasy and gentle fantasy?
It's just different words to describe
basically the same thing.
Yeah, they're just different ways to describe it.
I feel like, I mean, I realize they're, you know, we're slicing the pie really thin, but I was wondering if, because you first talked about this as cozy fantasy, and I thought, does it have queer characters?
Yes.
It does.
Yes. In different titles. And, you know, what makes this a little different than regular fantasy, kind of like a book that's romance, if it's going to have a happy ending, like things are going to be okay, even though the characters are going through different things. This is not a book that will wreck people.
I
love that term. It wrecked me.
Yeah, fantasy
it won't
in general
wreck you.
Doesn't do that, does it? Fantasy's not supposed to wreck you.
It can. Fantasy, immersive fantasy can, but Gentle Fantasy probably
won't. Michelle, you were talking earlier about some of your students wanted to be wrecked by books. What did they mean by that?
Well, first of all, here's the background. This week, my young writers are in town. Since 2009, I have run a program that brings teenagers to campus to read and write, and they live in dorms, and they have a kind of, they're high school students who have a college experience. It's an all-scholarship program. It's an incredible program. And since I retired, I don't know the graduate students anymore. I've been gone long enough that there's an entirely new cohort. So I'm spending a lot of time with them this week, and they have been talking about books that wreck them. They mean books that feel like they're being flayed alive when they read them. The one that came up first was, and I'm going to rely on Cassie for the author's name, maybe, The Vegetarian, which has gotten an enormous amount of attention, newish literary novel.
Marcus will be looking it up. He'll let us know.
Kang.
The Vegetarian.
Something. Is it Kang? Is the last name K-A-N-G? Anyway.
We're hopeless. But it is a book that kind of does fillet you. And the other book we thought of, and again, I'm gonna mangle the author. I'm not even going to try it, was A Little Life. And I don't want to be flayed when I read. So again, we're back to like, what do we read? I want to read literary fiction, but I don't want to read books that are essentially about how awful people are or how terrible. Mm-hmm.
But
the
that's
world
what
is.
You were hearing a lot about from young readers. That
they love, a lot of them just love that.
Okay, let's talk about something lovely. What do you have for us?
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to just pivot away from any of the things that I brought with me on my list, not because they are all books I love and they are not books that flay you alive, but there's a lot of death and sadness in them. Listening to Chris talk about cozy fantasy made me think about children's books that I loved as a child, that my daughter then loved as a child, that are still in print, and that I think adults, of course, they're child characters, and that's the main difference between fantasy for children and for adults. The writer Edward Eger, do you know Edward Eger, Chris?
I don't.
Oh, I'm so excited to tell a children's librarian about an author. So these books were published in the 40s, and it's not exactly a series. The books are Half Magic, The Time Garden, spelled T-H-Y-M-E, Knight's Castle, Magic by the Lake. Although they're not a series, sometimes the characters reappear, and they are the gentlest, most delightful magical books, and the magic is always slightly askew. It's a group of kids. Half Magic, which is the place to begin, is about this group of children who find a coin, and they discover through trial and error that it provides half magic, so that any wish they make, they get half of. And they never know exactly what half they're going to get. So if you wish to be on a desert island, you could end up on a desert with camels.
and no water.
And they eventually figure out how to wish for double what they want to try to get what they want. And they're witty, they're smart. I reread them periodically. So it's not true that I don't read fantasy. I can go back to my childhood fantasy books, but I highly recommend them if you have a kid who's, I would say, it's that 8 to 10 or 11 range. So almost middle grade.
See Brian Lord cover to cover. Yes. He'll hook you up with Edgar.
Absolutely.
Edward Eger, E-A-G-E-R.
Edward Eger.
Yeah. Can I recommend another? So this is going to come, and I don't know, I may have talked about this. Since I'm on the show periodically, I can't remember from one visit to the next, but the Betsy Tacy books.
Oh, I have a friend who absolutely loves those books.
Same writing in the same period. And this helps me circle back to the idea of girls and women's friendship. So Maud Hart Lovelace was a writer who grew up in Mankato, Minnesota. She wrote books for adults and then was telling her small, then small daughter stories of her childhood growing up in Mankato and began to write them. And the first novel in the series is called Betsy Tacy, and it's about 2 5-year-old girls based very closely on Maud's childhood relationship with her best friend. Mankato is renamed Deep Valley, and a third best friend enters at the end of the first book. And the books, the first 4 books, take place between ages 5 and 12, and then there are teenage books and adult books, and they take the girls through their lives into college and beyond. And I think maybe the last, I don't know if the last one is Betsy's Wedding or Betsy and the Great World, but they are gorgeous books. They take place at the turn of the 20th century because they're about Maud's childhood. And I will say this, they're the books that made me a writer because I knew that they were autobiographical. And I knew that Betsy, who wanted to grow up to be a writer, had grown up to be a writer because there was Maud. And they were out of print for years. I found them in my public library. They came back into print when my daughter was two, and I immediately bought the entire series. We have, both of us, replaced the first four books, I believe 10 times over the years, because they're paperbacks and they have just fallen apart from rereading. She loved them so much that there's a scene in the first book, which is a scene, now back to death, that taught her about death. When she was three and I read the book to her for the first time, and there's a tree. I'm not going to describe the scene because you have to come across it yourself for the first time. She has a tattoo covering her entire right forearm of that tree.
Remind us of the author.
The author is Maud Hart Lovelace.
Lovelace, okay.
And the books are, if you just look for the first four books, have actually been republished in the Betsy Tacy Treasury, which is a great way to get them. And I have recommended them to little boys as well as little girls. And there's a fierce Maud Hart Lovelace fan base. I don't reread them regularly as an adult. I reread them with my daughter and I've reread them with other children. But there are lots of adults who are obsessed with them.
Lovelace. Top that, Cassie Rose.
Well, I'm going to...
I know you will.
I said I brought a snack, so okay, I'm going to bring my...
I thought the Helen Schulman was your snack. That's not your snack.
No, that's not my snack. Okay. The snack is called... It's A Case of Mice and Murder by Sally Smith. And it is a mystery. Some people might call it a cozy mystery. I don't know. But anyway, it takes a lot for me to really... say yes when a publisher is contacting me to a debut, and especially a debut mystery. But I did to this because of how she described it and because of where it takes place, which is in the Inner Temple and the Middle Temple in the heart of London, which is where the courts, the judges, the barristers are in London. This is in 1901, so it's historical fiction. And that setting is compelling. And so too is the detective, who is Sir Gabriel Ward, who's a king's counsel. And he is someone who lives in the Inner Temple. He lives inside his mind. His apartment is filled with books. And one day he walks into his office and he stumbles on the dead body of the Lord Chief Justice. And the odd thing about it is that while he's formally dressed, and we will learn that he's been at a special dinner later, but he has no socks and no shoes on, which of course is just appalling to that environment. So what happens is that the treasurer of the Inner Temple calls in Gabriel Ward and says to him, I want you to investigate this and you have 1 week. Now the thing about the Inner Temple or the temple is that it is a cloistered environment in London. It still is. It acts like the Vatican, so that the police are not involved, and neither the mayor has no jurisdiction over this area. So anyway, he says you have a week to look into this, and Gabriel pushes back because he's an introvert, doesn't want to have to go to the outside of the temple. And also, he's got another case going on, which is where the mice comes in. He is defending a publisher over a children's book where an author has come up and claimed that she is the author of the book that has gone gangbusters and earned tons of money. And the publisher could not find who the author was when the manuscript was dropped at his doorstep years ago. And so you've got these two plots going on that are intricately woven. The characters are great. The time stamp is great. And this whole intergoings of the interior of the temple is fascinating. The next... in the series of this, as I said, this is the first one. The next one comes out in November, so people would not have to wait long to get it. I did not know what the solve was to the crime until the very end.
You mean why he didn't have shoes and socks?
Why? Well, who killed him? Yes, oh, yeah. That, and who killed him, and also So yes, she does it very well. She's extraordinarily, Sally Smith, and she is, I believe, a retired barrister that I do believe, if I can look quickly at, she was a King's Counsel, and so she clearly knows that life. She's done it well.
That is a recommendation from Cassie Rose. This is the Book Show. We have 2 minutes left, so you each have 20 seconds for one more, if you want.
Rich people behaving very badly on an island that they own. These Summer Storms by Sarah McLean. If you loved the We Are Liars series, make this your next read.
Michelle Herman, 20 seconds.
Diana Athill's book, Somewhere Towards the End. It's, you know, not new by any means. It's like 20 years old, but it's a fabulous book about what it's like to get near the end of your life.
Okay, more death. Great.
but she's cheerful.
But cheerful,
totally
death.
Cheerful.
Cheerful death.
Girl, 1983. It comes out next week. It's by Lynn Ullman, daughter of Liv Ullman, and it is fiction and memoir.
Ooh.
Recommendations from our panel. I want to thank Cassie Rose, WOS book critic. Anyone who loves to read will want to know Cassie's blog, which is thelongestchapter.com. Michelle Herman, keep writing, keep coming back, keep dancing. You're the star at Flux and Flow in Clintonville and choreographing and dancing everywhere. And Chris Hickey, what would we do without you and your quick picks and our friends at the Columbus Library? And congratulations again on the fantastic book festival.
Thank you.
And again, Lauren Hagen, the CEO of the library, will be my guest on this program next Friday at 11, along with Maureen O'Brien, the brand new CEO of the Columbus Symphony. And my man, Chad Whittington, who is the head of Kappa, will be here as well. My thanks to Chris Johnston for making it radio. Thank you, Chris. Thank you to Marcus Charleston, our producer, who always gives us the author's name. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend, the book show on 89.7 NPR News.